Herzlich willkommen bei MQ zum Hören. Mein Name ist Bettina Leidl, Direktorin des Museumsquartier Wien, und ich freue mich, euch die Diskursvielfalt im Museumsquartier auch akustisch näher zu bringen. Ihr erhaltet spannende Einblicke in Kunst, Kultur, Nachhaltigkeit und Diversität. Bei den MQ-Gesprächen diskutiert Historiker, Philosoph und Bestsellerautor Philipp Lomm mit seinen Gästen die großen gesellschaftspolitischen Fragen aus sozialer, politischer und wissenschaftlicher Perspektive. MQ-Gespräche. Die erste Ausgabe der MQ-Gespräche trägt den Titel 21st Century Vertigo. Unsere Zeit wirkt oft wie ein Übergang zwischen zwei Weltordnungen. Die alte ist im Zerfall begriffen, die neue hat sich noch nicht herausgebildet. Vor 100 Jahren nannte der Philosoph Antonio Gramsci eine ähnliche Phase Zeit der Monster. Gesellschaftliche Spannung, wachsende Ungleichheit und wiederkehrende Gewalt sind Anzeichen dieser Umbrüche. Doch welche Kräfte treiben diese Veränderungen? Dies diskutiert Philipp Lomm mit dem bulgarischen Politologen Ivan Krastev.
Tonight I'm really thrilled to greet Ivan Krastev. Ivan, welcome and thank you for being our first guest.
It was a smart choice because nevertheless who is next is going to be an improvement.
We will see about that at the end of the evening, but 21st century vertigo. We're living in a time when one order has ended and another one hasn't begun yet. And this is the kind of time that begets monsters. There are many such monsters underway and new ones seem to be born every day. And we seem to be living in an old order that is no longer working. This is the cheerful beginning of the evening. And I would like to speak to Ivan particularly about what happens when societies, and I mean here, I may be using the word we a certain amount in the course of the evening. And when I do that, people always come back to me and say, who is we? Let me just say my we that I will be using is the Western wealthy we. And in these Western wealthy societies, I can't speak for any others. We seem to have lost any sense of a good future. The best thing that can happen to us is that the present never ends, that present privileges are kept, that no great changes are allowed to happen. And this is the beginning of our discussion this evening.
Thank you very much. Let's start with the idea of the vertigo, because Kundera has an interesting definition of vertigo. He said vertigo is not the fear of falling. Vertigo is the desire to jump against which we are struggling. And I do believe this frames nicely what we are facing now. Listen, there was centuries and centuries in which people do not have particularly idea of the future because they believed in the cycle idea of history. And then basically, your past is your future. So the idea of the future is something very recent. The idea that future, which is very different than the present, is something that is very much a part of modernity. And don't forget, this idea of the past as the future still lives with us. We talk a lot about basically migration as people who are crossing physical borders. But if you see some of the voters, for example, for a far right, they're also migrants which basically wants to move in time, not in space.
Back in time.
Back in time. You want to go to the world that you know. I'm not saying this even in a kind of way of being angry with people, because when you don't understand where you are, you're basically trying to find the place in which you feel at home. And the major characteristics of the situation that you described is, first, future used to be a project. And there were different projects. There were the communist project, there was the Nazi project, there was a liberal project, but basically on all of them, basically believe that future is there, future is progress, you try to shape society in one or the other. Now future is much more projections. Projections about climate, how warm it's going to be and who is going to survive. Demographic projections, what is going to be the population, how old it's going to be, economically, what are the projections. And as a result of it, you have this kind of a story in which suddenly we start fearing the future. So the best thing that the future can do is never to arrive. On the other side, you basically have the feeling that future has already arrived. and you walk around. And I'm saying this because this idea of homelessness, I find as a very important thing. Different people, for different reasons, do not have the feeling that they're at home, because home is a place that you basically believe that you understand, and also you have the feeling that it's a place that you understood. And suddenly many people believe that they're living in the world which they don't understand, but also they have the feeling that they're not understood. And that was going on the level of language. In the English language, feel at home has almost the same meaning as feel free. Because at home you can do things that you're not doing otherwise. At home you're not afraid that you're going to be misunderstood. At home you can basically be dressed as you want, you can move. And this sense that you're living in the world that you don't understand is, we don't want the present to continue. In my view, this is also what is happening. We're even not kind of sure, because the present is becoming this transition to a future that we don't know. And in my view, this is the story. People have the different fears about the future. By the way, I do believe that the major distinctions between the left and the right is very much based on what they fear. If you go particularly for the younger generation, it's climate, and then you basically live as a last man. For the right, it's much more demographic fears. I'm not the last man, but I'm the last Bulgarian, or the last Hungarian, or the last Austrian. But in a certain way, you start to perceive the world from the idea that you are the last man. And I do believe this creates this very strange story in which, listen, we're living better than any before. So this is true. But on the other side, we are so much apocalyptic that even when we see something that is nice, we start to be scared. Because this is very much Bulgarian in me. But in Bulgaria, there are two important sayings. That too good is not for good. And that nothing bad comes on its own. So in this kind of an optimistic universe, you have it here.
As we're delving a little bit into collective psychology here, what you're describing, this sense of no future, this, it's also a question of mortality. And it's a question of individual and collective mortality. We are modifying our idea of our individual mortality, and people are talking about immortality or living many lifespans. And at the same time, we have the feeling democracy can die. National state may be an old model. All the old collectives are breaking down. Where does that leave people, this curious new kind of, I mean, states and things like that were immortal things that you could find yourself in. That is no longer so.
This is a great point, because I also believe that something very important is happening on this level. If you go to the Silicon Valley, you're going to see people who truly believe in the individual immortality. You can see these really super rich people who are investing tens of millions of dollars about certain type of a small diseases, which they believe that they're genetically exposed to, because they believe that if they're going to survive for 15, 20 years more, we're going to end up with immortal life. Or even if it's not immortality, but if you're going to live so long that you don't remember that you're alive anymore, so you're immortal. At the same time, the mortality of nations is becoming critically important. In a certain way, you suddenly realize how many cultures has disappeared. As, again, I'm coming from a small kind of a nation, and the story is in hungry tears. Anybody is going basically to write in Bulgarian, to read in Bulgarian. Before, because you know that you're mortal, you start to live with the idea that if I'm going to write a great poem, or if I'm going to have a great conversation with Philip Bloom, it's going to be so incredibly important that everybody is going to remember, and I'm going to die, but basically I'm going to live in the hearts of the people. And now this is not exactly like this. And you start to fear, by the way, Woody Allen has a point on this. He said, I don't want to live in the hearts of the people. I want to live forever, but in my apartment in Manhattan. But this story of, this is why the idea of the sacrifice is becoming so difficult to explain to the modern man. So if high culture, you're going to write a novel which is going to be read forever, and suddenly you're not sure. You're not sure that people are going to read novels. You're not sure that they're going to read novels on the language that you're writing on. And then this starts to create this strange sense of fragility in which we're living longer and longer. And plus, the intergenerational contract, in a way, in my view, is broken. I have been very much interested in the recent years in everything connected to demography, but not so much. I'm not a demographer, but demographic imagination. And then you suddenly understand that we are living in a society which basically are shrinking in terms of population. Not simply becoming colder, but probably you don't know that in even now, more than 50% of the countries in the world, women has less than 2 kids, and as a result of it, basically, these societies cannot replace themselves. In a certain way, you have such a dramatic shrinking and aging that in society like South Korea, in 20 years, they're going to have half of the population that they have now. Listen, this is dramatic. This is 20 years. But secondly, you cannot understand why. Because normally, we know that there are certain kind of a very important factors that is changing this. We know about education, particularly education of women and so on. But you also believe that social policies very much affect this. But more and more, you understand it's not about social policy. For example, a country like Finland, which has a very generous social policies, where the women are really respected, because about South Korea, there are some suspicions about kind of the nature of the South Korean marriage atmosphere. But they, why? And it's a cultural choices. And then suddenly you said, okay, what is happening? And if somebody, if you have a family without kids, are they think about the future the same way? And also the very idea of tradition. I was talking to somebody, a Jewish friend of mine, and he said, to be Jewish does not mean that you have a Jewish grandfather. It means that you have a Jewish grandchildren. And then imagine for the moment, a moment in which, in many societies which are moving dramatically, grandchildren and the grandparents does not speak the same language. I'm very lucky that my kids speak Bulgarian, but do you know how many people of countries that basically left? The only language that grandparents and grandchildren share is food. You go in this family and you're going to see grandparents basically feeding the kids all the time because you don't have the language in which to express your warmness and so on. And I do believe this is an extremely important moment because this kind of a change, and by the way, this change goes also economically. You are talking about generations, but the baby boom generation is living and they're living also with a lot of wealth that they're going to leave to their children. You see housing, you see this and that, and there are going to be many people that basically are not going to have the same type of a housing going on. So I do believe something really radically is happening on it. It's happening so quickly.
It's happening so quickly gives me an important next point. I mean, you just connected the demographic imagination, as you call it, with the idea of mortality. And of course, we live in shrinking populations. That means we live in aging populations, and aging populations will make different political choices from populations of countries where 40-50% of the people are under 18. Of course, these are different climates, and of course, demography is therefore really key for this factor. But you also, one other fact that I think, and perhaps particularly connected with an aging population, when we talk about social change and visible social change, we very often talk about migration. And of course, there's a clear bond here, because if our populations no longer produce new generations that are large enough to fulfill the social contract, we will need migration. But on the other hand, migration often seems to be just to be a sort of symbolic or symptomatic discourse of change, because you can identify migrants very easily on the street. They become symbols of difference. If you look on the rest of the street, you see everything else has actually changed as well, apart from the buildings, but the migrants, of course, stand out. My question to you would be, my personal suspicion is that by far the biggest driver of our social disorientation is technological change. The explosion of new technology in our lives that change everything from our dating to our learning to our living to our communication. And change it so fast that our societies have no chance to adapt to them, to integrate them into their habits, into their rituals, even into their laws, but because by the time the laws are written, the technology is four generations further. How can we coexist with this creature of ours that is growing much faster than we can understand?
I'm not the greatest person to be asked about technology. I should confess that I started to have a mobile phone for the first time during COVID. But not for major ideological reasons. Simply, when you don't have a phone, smartphone, people are coming for meetings on time. Because they cannot call you and to tell you that they're going to be 15 minutes late. But I'm saying this because if you go back and try to see in our own life, do you remember when for the first time you have a smartphone? You're going to be surprised how soon it was. But it so much take our lives that you have the feeling that it was always there. And because you start to have that it's always there, it's not simply that everything is changing very fast, but in a certain way it's changing under the radar. You're not understanding the change. You're not understanding how much your everyday practices are changing, the way you communicate with people and changing. And I'm going to give you an example on the level of intergenerational stories. When I was younger, I go home and my grandmother was there and nobody else is there, so we should talk. And I was asking her questions, and she was answering. And I knew certain things about how she was living because there was just two of us and we were talking. So now I'm all the time talking to friends, to family, and so on. Even if the grandmother is there, you're never going to spend so much time because you have so many much more options. And when you're not asking people questions, they start forgetting. Suddenly, she's not going to remember her own life because they're not there, the grandchildren, to ask a very simple question, how you have been, what you have been eating, what you have been doing, what you have been doing here and there. Suddenly, we start much more intensively to communicate, but much more with our peers. And certain type of a knowledge is disappearing, certain type of a knowledge is being there. Secondly, also the idea of the knowledge, what has disappeared is the idea of discovery. For example, the very fact that you can order any book on Amazon and it can come in a week is changing your relations to books. I remember there was a time in which basically you go to a place and you go to a bookstore and you can buy this book, and in a certain way your relations is kind of almost existential encounter. Now everything is easier. And certain type of commercial practices, not simply technological, is also changing our life. I have a 23-year-old daughter. She's a neuroscientist. And she's from the generation that know that when you're buying a dress, you can immediately return it the next day and the shop is going to be happy. But this idea that you're all the time returning everything, that you can redecide everything, that in a certain way, no decision is final. And the very idea of freedom is that you can basically choose all the time. Listen, this is affecting everything. Albert Hirschman, one, in my view, of the great social thinkers of the last century, he has this book which particularly influences me a lot about exit voice and loyalty. And he was saying, listen, there are certain things that you cannot easily leave. Your political party, your family, your country. Now everything is very easy to leave. Have you seen, for example, how you have now rankings who are the best passports in the world? By the way, number one is Singapore. Normally before, you get the passport and the passport gives you the sense that you're belonging. Now the value of the passport is how much easier you can live. How many more countries basically easy you can visit. You don't need basically to have visa, this and that. In a strange way, all this kind of a celebration of getting an American passport, which was so important of all kind of myth of the United States, was you're getting a passport and you don't need to travel anymore. You don't need to run anymore. You have basically entered the place in which you don't need to run after. And now basically the passport is when you're changing. First of all, people like to have many passports. As many as possible. And all of this is perceived as a travel document. I do believe all these are major changes, and they are very much connected to the fact that we want everything to happen and to happen very quickly. By the way, this is one of the problems that is becoming a major problem for democratic politics. I have learned, I'm a political scientist, but everything that I learned in politics, unfortunately, was by a taxi drivers. And one taxi driver told me, listen, the problem with the politics is that we start treating politicians in the way you're treating electricians. The idea is, I do not have a light, do something and do it in 30 minutes. So what is really changing is the idea of time dramatically. Everything should happen and should happen immediately. And this kind of immediate gratification, the fact that you are not ready to postpone, has something to do also with the changing view of the future. And here technology is incredible. When our talk was introduced, the speaker said, curators are important because they should ask the important questions. This is true. In the age of artificial intelligence, the very idea of the authorship is about questions. Because artificial intelligence can answer you any question. The only difference is, can you ask an interesting question, by the way, in the way that artificial intelligence can answer it? This, by the way, is going to change science and particularly social sciences in a big way. So suddenly, we're the one asking questions. But the thing that is disappearing in all this is personal experience. And I feel this very strongly, because when you say everything is moving, you have technology, you have identity, the story that always stays with me is as Giuliano Amato was one of the very important intellectual figure in Italy, but for a while he was like all Italians, prime minister several times and ministers 100 times. But at some point he was a minister of interior, and he was told that there was a woman living somewhere in one of the neighborhoods in Rome with a lot of migrant population who has not left her apartment for more than 3 years. And he decided to visit her. And he went there and he said, "Mother, are they treating you badly? Why are you not getting out?" And she said, no, people are very nice to me, but I'm not getting out because it's not my neighborhood anymore. I'm not going to meet anybody that I know. The smells are different. It's not about people. She said, people are nice. And I do believe the other thing that we don't recognize is we see only the change of the people who are moving. But you can move nowhere and everything can change.
But you've also talked a lot about the fact that you come from a country where you see the change in people who are not moving, who are left behind.
No, listen, the change is incredible, because basically you have towns that used to have 45, 50,000 people living there 20 years ago, and now they are 8,000 people, 9,000 people. In what scene, nothing is changing. Everything is changing for these people. And I do believe this is the other story. People always see, this is, by the way, the problem of our
lives.
And
there are more old and less educated people who stay.
Old, educated. By the way, in Bulgaria, every month, at average, a village is dying, which means that the last person living in this village is dying. And this is extremely important to experience this, because also it is interestingly enough, when you talk to some of the voters of the far right, and they're going to tell you, migrants at least has a place to go back. I don't. This story, but this is, because you should, in my view, psychologically, this is critically important, because when they're talking about, it's not a nostalgia for certain economy, it's not a nostalgia for incomes, it is nostalgia for certain ethnic makeup of society. And of course, this makeup cannot be returned at all. And by the way, this is the fact that we looked in the way we were looking 10 years ago is totally different if you go back to history. I'm always giving this example. If you see two maps of Europe based on cultural and ethnic diversity of societies, and you get a map from year 1900 and year 2000, you're going to see on both two Europes, one being ethnically much more diverse and the other ethnically more homogeneous. The only problem is that they change places. In the year 1900, the much more ethnically homogeneous Europe was Western Europe, France, Germany, and then you come to the Habsburgs, Ottoman, Russia's land, where it was a total kind of a mixture of people. In the year 1939, one-third of the population of Poland were not ethnic Poles. And then comes 20th century, And we basically all the time are saying how much people are moving in the 20th century, most of these being forced movements. But they're moving in the way that basically their states were becoming much more ethnically homogeneous. There was a transfer of populations, Bulgarians and Greeks, Bulgarians and Turks, Turks and Greeks. Then basically what you have is the World War II and Poland in 1945 or 1948. 95% of the population was ethnic Poles because Jews have been destroyed, the Germans have been expelled, the Ukrainians basically have been there. But here is the interesting story. And then comes the story of the buildings. And listen, if you see now the electoral map of Poland, you're going to see that Western Poland is voting much more liberal for all these years compared to the parts that have been part of the Russian Empire. And you're going to say, oh, but this is so natural, basically, they have been part of a much more liberal regime. But listen, these are totally different people. All of the people living in Western Poland were people that basically have been transferred from the Russian lands. It appeared that the very atmosphere, the pavements, the buildings, and so on, are also changing people. You cannot explain this basically from where they're coming. Most of these people were really coming not from the Western lands because they were German living. For example, you mentioned Wrocław and some of these places. I'm saying this because there is something extremely interesting about how also places, buildings are shaping people and not simply people are shaping certain type of experiences. And then you go basically to the 2000 map. And you look at the map and you're going to see that Western Europe is highly diverse. Look at Germany, Poland, by the way, Austria. One of the interesting stories that even I can imagine that many of you are going to be surprised if I'm going to give you some figures about, for example, of the percent of the children in the first 4 years of schools in Vienna, how many of them do not have German as a first language. We're talking around 70%. Listen, this is enormous. So then you go to Eastern Europe where basically you have this ethnic homogenization, which is also starting to change. And this is part of the story. The very idea of identity is changing. There was a friend took me to a restaurant in the 19th district, which is an Italian restaurant. It was created by the Italians. So the food is Italian, the menu is Italian, the music is Italian, but since 20 years, the owner is not Italian. The cook is not Italian. None of the waiters have ever been to Italy. And none of the people do not speak a single word in Italian. So my question is this an Italian restaurant? And the answer is, it is an Italian restaurant for me. I don't believe that Italians living to Vienna will go there. But this very idea of what it means to be Italian or not, is this the menu and so on. By the way, when I look at the menu, probably this is the definition of Habermas, of constitutional patriotism. Basically, the menu matters. But all this transformation is happening all the time. And the most interesting is many of them we even not notice. And this is part of the story we're talking about.
This is a very interesting story. And I want you to help me to rescue a term. Before that, I also have to tell you that I also owe my part of my political education to taxi drivers, and there was one Viennese taxi driver not so long ago who said that he hated democracy, and I asked him what his alternative was, and he said, well, that's of course monarchy. And I asked him, why is a monarchy better than a democracy? And he answered me, na eh klar, da haben wir nur einen Trottel. Which is a refreshing way to look at modes of government. But the term I would like you to help me rescue is culture. Culture is a term that has wandered into the right part of the political spectrum. We think of Leitkultur, of leading culture, so beloved by the ÖVP. Culture has become a code word for conservatism, for holding things back, for being a bit racist, for not wanting things to change. Now, we have both independently of each other had conversations with a social scientist called Olivier Roy, who made a very exciting observation, I think. He wrote a book called in France, very elegantly in French, L'aplatissement du monde, so the flattening of the world. And he basically says that in a world of increasing digitization, of increasing migration, old cultural hierarchies collapse. and where they once were in order to reestablish a system of order, external norms are being put in their place. So to give you an example that helps me to grapple with that idea, there are wonderful films about Vienna 1900, and you can take a tram ride in archive footage around the Ringstrasse. And you can see this tram from the cameraman was standing on the tram, and he trundles around the ring. And you see quite a lot of traffic, surprising amount of traffic. The first cars, horse carts, hand carts, pedestrians, cyclists. Every woman is wearing a long dress. Every man is wearing a three-piece suit and a hat. And what you do not see, which is always the interesting thing, and this is true for all cities in the world until about 1930, is a single traffic sign. There are no traffic boards, there are no traffic lights, there are no zebra stripes, but apparently the whole thing works by mutual arrangement. Now, today we have a lot more traffic and bigger populations in our cities, so things have changed. But if you do the same ride today on the same space, you see everybody wearing what the hell they want because we're all free, which means that they're all wearing the uniform of our peer group because we're so free. But at the same time, we're screamed at incessantly by traffic signs, by boards that tell us when to move and when to stop and where to go and what not to do. I find this idea really compelling, that to ask after the importance of culture, that means the importance of a sufficient amount of shared information, of shared practices, perhaps even of shared rituals, in order to be a society. And what happens when this culture drains away and leaves a lot of people who have external norms and rules to govern them?
Listen, and here, 30 seconds for commercial. Institute for Human Sciences invited Olivier Roy for the Vienna Humanities Festival. He really made a really important observation. And it is, in a certain way, so obvious that when I'm going also to retell it, you'll believe that you always knew it. But the story is, what is culture? Culture is like the native language. You don't know when you learned it. You are speaking it before you know the grammar. There is many things that you understand simply because it is there. It happened to you. And you have a lot of shared exactly of what is self-evident. Okay, then the life was slightly slower, so it was much easier to save your life if somebody breaks the rules. But the most important is that there are certain things that you know without knowing when you learn them. And to a certain extent, this is culture in one level. And of course, the culture is also that certain type of a national canon, that if you want to be perceived as a respected, cultured Austrian, there are certain things that you should know. So when I'm talking, I can refer to them, and I really can expect that all of you know what I'm talking about. If you don't know, it's your problem, it's not my problem. Now, this is a huge problem. It is becoming a huge problem. First of all, we have the first translator who does not have a native language, and it's a Google Translate. Google Translate probably is best in English than in any other language, but they do not have this type of a name. All the languages that they have learned in the way machine learns. And I'm saying this because what Olivier Roy is very right about it is, suddenly the very fact that you have the feeling that you're living with a lot of foreigners is not the number of foreigners. By the way, we know from sociology that the places that are most sensitive about migration are places without migrants. And you know also on the electoral maps, in a certain way, the migrant that you don't know is the most kind of a dangerous one. But suddenly you cannot be sure that the other person is a person that can understand rightly what you want to communicate. And as a result of it, we start to codify. This is why, for example, emojis, this Japanese smiling or I don't know what doing, things are becoming so important, because everything should have a very strict meaning, because otherwise you're afraid that you're going to be misunderstood or that you're going to offend somebody. But this is changing slightly the pleasure of life. It is very difficult, by the way, to be on a public talks these days because of jokes. And I like joking. This is how I was kind of socialized. But you cannot be sure anymore how people are getting your jokes. You cannot get it because of the national context. You cannot get it because of the generational context. And to be absolutely honest, in the United States, I stopped joking because I'm afraid that otherwise they can joke with me. No, but this is real. And this is real also coming from respect. You don't want to offend somebody simply because you're going to say something that is going to have a totally different meaning in their culture. It's not that anybody is going to press on you. This is the story. What was a culture? And this is the idea of home. Home is a place in which you don't know, and probably people are saying things which are kind of very ambiguous, but this ambiguity makes life much more pleasant. Now it is different. Tell me, what are the cultural references that we have to which I can refer and I can be sure that everybody in a room knows it? Is there a book, even in this room, of highly cultured people that have been written in the last 20 years that all of us have read? And listen, this is also telling you something how culture has changed. There was a time in which people were not reading. People were rereading. For a long time, they have been rereading basically one book, and this was the Bible. But even after that, do you know how many people basically knew by heart books, poems? What happened on the commercial level is happening on the cultural level. We all the time have so many new books coming. There's so many new things. You all the time now, you have these classes in fast reading. No, but this is an incredible change. People used to know, for example, one of the interesting story, for example, during the Soviet times, most of the poems of Akhmatova was preserved with ever being written on paper because she didn't want to risk, and basically this can create you a major trouble, because people, tens and hundreds of people, have been remembering them. And I do believe this is also changing. By the way, we totally outsource our memories to the smartphones and machines. How many of telephone numbers you remember?
Of course, people who are more tech optimists than you are, perhaps I am, would say, but that's because we now have our memory free to remember much more useful things than telephone numbers.
Really? Normally you remember 10 or 15 telephone numbers, but this is basically about your closest friends and family and people. And this was something more than just remembering telephone numbers. It's in a certain way, it is about importance of these people for you. And now all people are equally important. Of course, you have priority numbers on your telephone. I'm saying this and I don't believe it is good or bad. So from this point of view, I'm not still so old in order basically to believe that the world is going wrong. I simply want to say that so many small things have changed. The way we're reading, the way we're understanding this. For example, even the conversations like this, this is very interesting. And for me, it's always kind of surprised that people are coming, because for many, particularly young people, it's much more natural to see this on the just on the screen. For them, it's much more natural. Basically, people are getting a lot of information. It's interesting also to see to what extent basically listening to books, podcasts, doing things. By the way, doing only one thing is not prestigious anymore. This is like having just one job. It does not pay well. This is an important practice, and this is about culture. And where Olivier Roy is right is he talks about the empire of norms. And this is like entering the world in which everything that you're doing a manual. Nobody expects that you should know anything. It should be kind of so easy, and it should be so equal, that in this society, everything is a foreigner. And I do believe this creates a tension, because basically, being a foreigner is good, but not all the time.
I want to talk to you a little bit about this idea of culture, of the sufficient communality, let's call it that, and the possibility of democracy. Because no two democracies are the same. Democracies have their own tradition. They work in very different ways. Look, for instance, we've just had a spate of European elections. And in fact, the elections in Great Britain and in Austria went very similarly. Because a large part of the former voters of the main Conservative Party went to the far right. Because of the electoral system, that means that in Britain, where only one candidate, the candidate with the most votes of every district, gets elected, The conservative vote was split, so Labour won by a landslide, and there is now a Labour government. And in Austria, because of a representational system, there is now a conservative government, and there might have very well been a right-wing government. So democratic systems are very different, and democratic systems rely on a certain amount of cultural knowledge, or do they? What is the possibility of democracies in a time of rapid historical acceleration?
In my view, the most important division for every democracy is the border between citizens and non-citizens. Because democracy is the way to include but also to exclude. Who belongs to a community and who does not belong. And in a certain way, no democracy creates a community. You start with the community and then this community is changing. And even this kind of a decisions about the nature of the electoral system and so on is very much based in a certain type of political crisis. Normally, many things that we see today were created for totally different reasons. One of the first articles that I have done professionally was based on the fact of certain things about Bulgarian constitution. Bulgaria was the first post-communist country to adopt a constitution, so there was hundreds of articles talking about constitutional borrowing. For example, why Bulgarians decided that the president should be 40-year-old if you want to be a president in order to be a candidate. There were three conditions. You should be born in Bulgaria, you should have lived in Bulgaria for the last 5 years, and you should be at least 40 years old. And there was a really very interesting article saying how much it is based that Bulgaria was borrowing from the Belgium constitution, which has a similar type of stories at some point. Listen, it was not like this. There were three persons at this moment in which we didn't want to run. One was the stronger person of the Socialist Party who was born in Moscow. The other was the former king who didn't live in the country for the last 5 years. And the third was one of the trade union leaders who was 37. And I was there and I remember why these conditions were put. But then, in a certain way, constitution, a certain type of a contextual decision forgotten. And then you start to find a deep meaning in this. Or people were asking the question, in the Grand National Assembly that made the constitution, we had 400 members of parliament. In a normal, 250. And people were saying how it happened like this, why it was not twice bigger like in the old constitution. For a very simple reason. In the building of the parliament, there was no more places than for 400 chairs. So we are always asking questions as a very important normative questions. And quite often the answer is different, either very low level, dirty politics, or the space which we're talking about. But this is interesting about tradition, and then you start to reinvent. And the important thing about political tradition. And here is, for example, Austria, what we know about Austria. Because when you come, we don't know much. This is why I'm asking question. But you know that Austria was a country with a very strong, after World War II, corporative culture and very much kind of a relations between political parties and knowing how to live in grand coalitions. And you're never going to know why if you don't know what happened here in the 1920s and 30s. The moment you read the first history, you know why it ended like this. And when a political scientist, and political scientists, we're not the most creative persons, unfortunately, we basically took a system out of the way it was born. We start to compare with other systems and not understanding where it comes from. But do you know, many of the people coming, they're going to forget where it comes from. And one of the strong stories that the very fact that it exists like this is also changing the nature, by the way, of political parties. One of the reasons that we have so much new parties emerging in Europe is that, by the way, the cost of politics became much cheaper. Because of all this social media story and others, you really can reach the voters in the way before you cannot. You need somebody to go, to knock on the doors, to do this and that. But by the way, the fact that you have so many new parties is also changing dramatically politics. Because you are giving the story of how Britain and Austria voted the same time and ended up with a totally different parliaments. But let's give you one more Bulgarian example. Bulgarians, we're quite interesting people. For the last 3 years, we're going to have the 7th parliamentary elections. We overperforming, which means that you have an election. We elect a parliament. The parliament cannot create a government. By the way, it can happen in Austria too. And then basically you go on elections again. And you're not going to be surprised that less and less people are voting on these elections, because when you ask for 6 or 7 times to vote in 3 years, you're slightly pissed off. By the way, the Israelis started, but we overdone them with this way. This is changing dramatically. And everybody's talking about polarization. But this is the combination between fragmentation and polarization. In order to polarize, you need still a kind of either a certain type of electoral system, like in the UK or US, or you need a very important cultural divide. Poland is a country like this, where you really basically see two Polands, totally value divided on all major issues. I'm saying this because I do believe you're right in one important thing. People talk about democracy as if the institutions that we have should be always like this. I was reminded recently by a colleague of ours, American political scientist, who started her course on American Constitution, saying this is the oldest democratic constitution in the world. It's 200 years old. And then turned to the students and said, what 200 things old you're going to buy today? Are you going to buy a car which is 200 years old? Or watch? The very idea that there is a tradition does not mean that you should not change things. And I do believe that the biggest story is, obviously societies are changing, but what exactly to change? And how to change it without basically to lose the values on which it is based? And here the very idea of what is freedom that we discussed, is freedom simply the possibility to change everything all the time? Is freedom something else? Is freedom about individual, or is it basically freedom about how we live together? I was talking about novels, and I was reading in Bulgarian translation Daniel Kelman's latest novel. And this idea is, you want to be a free artist, and probably you can do the films that you want to do in Nazi Germany. Are you freer there if basically if you're going to be in Hollywood and you're going to be pushed to do the films that you don't want to do? I do believe all these basic questions are coming back. And one of the stories that we are trying to avoid the basic questions and always go to smaller questions, how to deal with this crisis and that crisis. And probably it's time to ask some of these basic questions.
Well, let's ask one basic question at the end of our conversation, because you just talk about politics of crisis and democracy needs the future. We have elections, and if the elections don't go our way, we think, well, in 4 years' time, we're going to have another chance. This is not how things have to be for the rest of our lives. Therefore, we entrust the others to take power for a while, because they will also play the game. We are now in a position where, for instance, in the United States, but not only there, one of the candidates makes it very clear that he will no longer play the game. That he has spoken about using the military against political opponents. He has spoken about this being the last election people will ever have to vote in. And all of a sudden, democracy meets its own finality. And then you get something else, which so strongly characterizes our own time. Because I think politics, but especially democratic politics, without a future leads to a politics of emergency. You only have the moment, you only have the crisis of the moment, you no longer have a perspective for this crisis, and therefore you only have warring tribes.
I totally agree. By the way, Tocqueville described it beautifully. So when he was going through the United States writing Democracy in America, he figured out 4 characteristics of democracy that in my view are really important. He said there is something strange about elections. Before the elections, there is over-dramatization. Everybody is telling you that this is the most important elections ever, that if it is not going to change this and that, and the day after the elections, everything is normalized. So this kind of tension between over-dramatization and banalization is critically important for how democracy works. Secondly, and you're totally right, the night of the elections, this is like death. You look back, you look in the future. And the most important is that there are going to be next elections in 4 years. And even if you're going to lose, you're not going to lose much. You're not going to lose your property, you're not going to lose your life. Because if you believe that you can lose your property or your life, there is no reason for you to accept election results. If elections are really so existentially important, better go to bullets, not to ballots. And the third thing that he also found, in my view, this is really profound, was that many things are represented on the election day. But do you know what is not represented? Intensity. You who care a lot, and I who don't care much, our votes are equal. And this non-representation of intensity is so important because people who are not very much interested in politics, they also vote. And because they also vote, others should try to talk in the way to make sense for them. What I do believe is happening, and this is really, you're totally right, one of the things that really worries me very much in the American debate is this talk about the last elections. If you believe that it is last elections, there is no way to accept defeat. By the way, this is the most important. The idea of the future is critically important for democracy to work. Not simply future, but future that has two important characteristics. Future that can be changed. There should be something different also happening. But secondly, future that is promised to us and nobody can take it out of us. And this is changing a lot. I really do believe that this level of intensity is really becoming dramatic. But listen, we look at the United States because everybody talks about it, but it happens in many places. In a strange way, it is, in America it's more visible, probably we're much more surprised. By the way, years ago, when something stupid was happening in Bulgarian politics, people were going to say, this can never happen in Britain or it can never happen in the US. Nobody is saying this anymore. And in a certain way, funnily enough, coming from where I'm coming, from time to time, I believe that I understand American politics better than Americans.
I remember we had a conversation about 10 years ago, and it was the time of Brexit, so it wasn't quite 10 years ago. And I asked you about Brexit, and you said, you know, we in Bulgaria, we've always respected the British very much. They had an empire and that was dirty, but, you know, they were great diplomats, very cultured people, fair play. And now we're looking over there and we're thinking they're behaving like Bulgarians. But we're talking about what destroys, distends democracies. And I also want to give you the opportunity to ask perhaps three short questions. But let me just make one point and ask one last question to you. The point being, you say intensity is not represented in voting. And that is, I think, a very important point. What is overrepresented by now, and I think which is one problem we don't talk enough about, is simply money. Elon Musk is giving away $1 million a day to people who sign his petition, or rather, they enter a lottery to win $1 million, which is as close to vote buying as you can possibly get. But I have a suspicion that we have allowed ourselves to construct a new kind of aristocracy, exactly what the French Revolution rebelled against, a class of super rich people who have disproportionate influence on political decision making through all sorts of instruments they can avail themselves of, who do not pay taxes in the way that other people do, who are not subject to laws in the way that other people are. And that simply makes a travesty of the principle of one person, one vote. And you earlier said that people also need to have an interest to tie their fate to democracy. And of course, in the post-war era, there was economic growth and people could be part of it. But to just give you two little statistics, which are fascinating, from 1945 until roughly 1980, and we all know what happened in roughly 1980 with Thatcher and Reagan, productivity and wages went in lockstep and increased by about 100%. From then until today, productivity has increased another 150% and wages have bottomed out, which means that the entire lovely triangle that opened there went into the pockets of the people who are shareholders or so. To put it in other words, in the last 30 years, 40% of all profits have gone into 1% of pockets. That can't be good news for democracy. That can't be good news for a fair society that seeks to have fair representation of interests.
It is not. And of course, listen, there's such an obvious things. By the way, one of the biggest problems of starting to put a lot of money in politics is that at certain moment, this is a thing that you cannot stop. Because if you see the other party investing a lot, and if you care, this happening in the United States, you believe that you should do the same. And now you basically go, by the way, we don't know at some point how effective all this is. In much more simple places like Bulgaria, when you're buying the vote, you wanted basically to be sure how the person have been voting, because don't forget, the vote is secret. You can get the 1 million from Musk, but we don't know how you're going to vote. The famous saying is that democracy is not voting. Democracy is counting the votes. And I'm saying this because you're changing the very logic. It becomes competitive in an idiotic way. But this type of social inequality that you're talking about is not simply that some people are getting a lot of money that they should not have. Suddenly people start living in a totally different societies. And this has a lot to do, of course, to be honest, this 1% you don't see. But what is also happening, and this is very much about the rise of university education, suddenly you start really not to understand much people different than you, because the group in which you go, and by the way, now social media make it much easier to this, we're all the time talking to like-minded people. One of the major reasons for the rise of social inequality is basically the rise of the university level of women, which means that basically men and women, all of them graduating university or having PhD, are marrying each other. As a result of it, basically, you have all these men who never managed to graduate school, and these people are not going to have anybody to marry, because a very well-educated woman probably is not going to be highly inspired to do this. And by the way, this is a lot of the vote for the far right going, particularly near Germany. There is a lot of data on this. But the most important story is that suddenly you start to live in a world in which how the others are living, you don't know anymore, you don't understand, you don't believe that this is possible. Before, there was a certain type of places in which you're mixing different people. One was the army, by the way. You go to the army and you're mixing. Nevertheless, how educated you are, you end it in a certain place. There was also places in which also when it comes to people coming from different ethnic backgrounds, so industrial state was a mixer. The market is not mixing. The market is out and mixing because the market said, follow your choices. And our choices is to be with people like us. It's normal. And as a result of it, we end up in a society in which, for example, I remember my wife had been driving with a taxi before some elections in Bulgaria. And there was a guy who said that he's going to vote for a party, which a really very extreme party. And she said, I have never met in my life a person who is voting for this party. And he looked at her and said, I don't know anybody who is not voting for this party. And both of them were right.
Ivan, there's 1,000 more things that come to my mind. I would love to talk to you now about what I consider the most important political motivation possibly that is overlooked today, which is humiliation. I think so many people do not feel seen, do not feel recognized for reasons that are correct or incorrect, but that doesn't matter. They still feel humiliated. But because we have to come to some kind of close, I think we have discovered that we have agreed that democracy needs a future. Perhaps we could even go further and say democracy needs a project, a common project. And we've made certain bad experiences with common projects throughout the 20th century. Is there such a thing as a perspective, a common project for democracies in the 21st century?
When it comes to this last minute of every conversation, to be honest, I feel very uneasy. I'm not the person who knows the answers. And there is not a kind of a visionary sleeping in me. And I'm going to tell you why. All this is based very much on experiences. In a certain way, I'm coming from a generation, on one level, the advantage of this generation is that we have experienced how fast the world can change. Believe me, Bulgaria in 1989 was as sleepy as you cannot imagine. You can like or dislike the communist regime, but you believe it is stable like nature and you know your life for the last 30 years. And then after weeks, everything is changing. And on Friday, you cannot believe what you have been thinking on Monday. And this was the personal experience of everybody, regardless of their positions, regardless of their political views. This is a great experience. But then coming from this generation, also I have been listening to people having visions for this and that. And I knew that just having these words is not going to change much. I was walking to some of these collective experiences, and to be honest, some of these collective experiences we're totally underestimating. For example, people are totally underestimating the experience of COVID in politics, and to be honest, in Austrian politics. Everybody who talks about the votes that going for FPO is totally focusing on migration. I'm going to tell you that there was a lot of this coming from the experience of COVID, because for many reasons, by the way, for very different reasons, but one of the things that happened with COVID is that suddenly people has the possibility to change their political identity without recognizing this. I don't trust the government. I don't trust the government who basically so much cares to me that almost promising that nobody's going to die ever. I don't trust about this. I don't trust about that. And secondly, I want to be part of an enlightened minority. I know something that nobody else is doing. By the way, people can believe in very different conspiracy theories, but in a certain way, the most story is that I know something that nobody else is knowing. I have a close friend, and she's married for a doctor, and she's telling me a story that is always going to stay with me. So she was in a waiting room of a hospital, and somebody comes to her and saying, listen, don't do the vaccination. If you're going to do the vaccination, I don't know what Gates is going to do to you. She was so tired. She didn't want to discuss anything. So she said to this person, listen, there is a conspiracy, but you're getting a wrong one. There are too many people in the world. And those who are not vaccinated are going to die in the next year. And this woman looked to her and said, you're right. I knew that there was something that they were not telling us. I'm going to vaccinate. This story that you are part, that there is everything that you're hearing is a lie. And this is beyond left and right. And this is why this movement. Secondly, of course, I do believe it was great that people were vaccinated. But in order to vaccinate everybody, you start to basically say things which were not particularly true too. You start pushing your argument to the extreme in order basically to get people. And then people said, listen, but they lied to me and it's true. Probably even they didn't lie by intention. Probably back then they didn't know anything. But in a moment like this, you are trying basically to create a war type of a situation in which everything is a package. Nobody has the right to distance. Asking question is already wrong. This is why I'm talking about collective experiences. Listen, you say the experience now of war in places like Ukraine. Also, you have this type of experiences. It is the experiences that create collective projects. And there is a good news and bad news. When people are telling me that we're back in the 1920s or 1930s politically, I'm always going to tell them one thing. Remember, in the 1920s and 30s, our societies have been at average 15 years younger. All of the men were ex-soldiers. Obviously, it's not the same. But at the same time, there's certain type of experiences that we have. And these experiences are going to create really collective project of one way or the other. And by the way, people have their small collective projects. People are doing things. Is this going to end up of having a type of a future similar to the future in the way it was projected in the 20th century? I don't know. Probably it's going to be different. And this is why on this question about the vision, how it's going to be the project, when we start to talk about projects and about the future, we're becoming very nostalgic. I don't know this. I simply don't know. And from this point of view, on the last question, you should ask the artificial intelligence.
Well, I shall do that another time. But now I shall ask you. We don't have very much time left because this has been far too much fun. So perhaps we can squeeze in three quick-fire questions. Who would like to ask something? Gentlemen there, please. Is there a microphone No, I don't think there's a microphone. So please just ask your question. Have you got any practical perspectives of being homeless in a technological speeding world?
No, listen, it's a great question. I don't believe that it's one answer. Probably different people are going to do it differently. But first is, in my view, it's very important to have a right diagnosis of what really worries us. Because I was always making a major distinctions between fear and anxiety. Fear is something that you know what threatens you. And by the way, fear is a disciplining things. When I see somebody shooting at me, I know what I fear. The problem of anxiety is that suddenly you start fearing everything. And anxiety is making society ungovernable. In a certain way, I don't know, everywhere there is this kind of, you don't know where it comes from, everything worries you. And when we start to understand, yes, there is this vertigo moment, and this vertigo moment is connected to the fact that understanding of home in the way we have it probably has been changing, but then how you create it. And first of all, of course, it goes, you need a community. You cannot stay on your own. And how you're going to do it and how you care about other people in a certain way is taking much more about you than anything else. And by the way, we're going to be in a situation in which, strangely enough, the people who are now probably in their 30s or 40s year old, they're going to spend much more time than anybody of us caring about somebody. Because we're caring longer for our kids and because we're living longer than before, you're going to care also much more for your parents when they're going to be there. This is a new situation. And by the way, this is also a totally different idea of how the world is developing. And this gives you a sense of how you're getting your sense of what is freedom for me, what I'm ready to, with whom we're communicating and not. I had the feeling that from time to time we're really totally wasting time for things that, for example, there is this idea of networking, where you're meeting people for what? But really, for what? And then this is the sense of being on certain place. I was telling this Philip your story. I was reading the memoirs of one of the advisors of Obama. And he basically started to banning anybody who comes to his talks to have a phone with him. Because Obama is a good speaker, so he believes that people are coming to listen to him. And then he sees most of the people and they're paying $10,000 to listen to him. And they comment what they're doing simply is that they're turning his back to him while he was speaking just to have basically a selfie with him. But listen, these are things and these are choices. And obviously it's going to be different for different generations. But you decide for yourselves what gives you this kind of, how you're dealing with this vertigo anxiety moment, I find important. And I do believe this individual answers. Different people can find it differently.
If I may butt in here, I think that in times of digitization and social media, it's very important not to refuse yourself to them, but it's also equally important to valorize and concentrate on your analog life. On analog contacts, on contacts with real people, and on the fact that you have a body that lets you live. That sounds very, very basic and very, very stupid. But I think as our lives are volatilizing more and more into the digital space, remembering that we actually have analog existences with physical relationships will become ever more important. Can we have another question, please? There's the quickest hand and then the lady next.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Zafar. Coincidentally, I arrived in Vienna exactly 11 years ago. I'm a refugee from Afghanistan, and I'm an Austrian citizen now, Austro-Afghan. Starting from the dragonflies, they spend most of their life underwater, actually, and the only reason they come above water is for mating. So I have this dear memory in my mind. I traveled to Afghanistan about 2 years ago out of necessity. And I was standing at the bottom of the Hindu Kush Mountains. It was summer and the river was running. And the driver stopped there for a lunch break. And I saw thousands of dragonflies. And it made me feel at home, since you are talking about identity and home and homelessness. I know Vienna very well. I can probably walk around the city with my eyes closed. But sorry, Viennese people, I don't feel home here. I love the city. I feel Viennese very much. And as you mentioned, you said we were going to use the word we, and you said we mean we as the Western world. And I feel I'm divided between the two we's, the Western we and the Eastern we inside me. And this clash of cultures, I have experienced it firsthand and I have gone through it. And I actually don't have a question, but because I'm going to be honest with you. The reason I came here today is because I wanted to do networking, and I wanted to. So I'm going straight to the point. I wanted to do networking with some of the people from the Bruno Kreisky because I heard that they're having a conference on Afghanistan, the fourth one, and I wanted to be a part of it. I'm not asking for a job. I have a full-time job. I'm just offering my energy and time for free. And since you said networking is useless, so there we go.
Well, thank you, Zafer. And I'm
you
sure
know what?
If you...
It's great because what you did was not networking. You're connecting. Yeah. But listen, because you mentioned Vienna, and there is one thing about Vienna as a foreigner who is spending some time here and so on, which is really amazing, and which probably people who have been born here are not going to see. In my view, the charm of Vienna is that by walking, you can decide in which century you want to live.
Please, you had also had a question.
Hi, thank you so much for such an interesting talk. It's inspiring. I want to take you to the States and to the States political scene. You mentioned earlier that due to social media and having access to the public nowadays, more so than how it was in the old times, is that there are more political parties that are coming about or resurfacing in Europe and also down under. I find that not so true for the States. It's always down to two parties. The polarization is so malignant, and it's only Democrats versus Republicans, and the Independent Party, which tried to breathe a little bit of air through Bernie Sanders, was shut down. And I wonder whether the reason why this polarization that exists has to do with the culture, the previous drama due to the Cuban missiles and the Cold War between Russia and America, or what is it? Because I don't understand, and I don't think, I think a lot of people don't as well. Thank you.
Listen, the Americans here, I see my colleague Adam Schatz, who probably are going to give you a better answer. There is an interesting books on the American polarization. The one that I'm strongly going to recommend is Ezra Klein's book on this. But what is interesting is American system was done piece by piece. It's very federal. There are many things that are shocking. By the way, the nature of the system, you really cannot register. You should be registered in a number of states. The costs of political campaigns. But also what is interesting for me in this America, which I see and I was recently there, is that people are coming there, and people are coming with their fears and kind of strange experiences from different places and basically going there. I was, and I see of this after that being reflected, and somebody wrote to this. If you see many of the people around Donald Trump, you're going to see that some of them have spent some of their life, these white people coming from South Africa. Starting with Musk.
Like Elon Musk, like Peter Thiel, yes.
Peter Thiel, but Musk is a much more classical example. So in a certain way, he left when he was 18 years old. And for him, basically, what is happening in America, it's a bigger South Africa. In the same way, after 9/11, you have people who believe that America is simply a greater Israel surrounded by enemies and so on and so on. So all these people coming with their experiences, some of them quite traumatic, are going there. And suddenly America became collections of traumas, and these traumas being very much there, and because their political campaigning is really trying to address people very much on their identity and the way they're going to work and so on, instead of basically healing these traumas, basically you're making political story out of them. This is really sad. And this is really sad because as a result of the nature of the American political system, where only seven battleground states really matter, and in these seven battleground states, there are going to be 20,000 people which are going to go, you're focusing on them and you're not interested in a society as a whole. I'm really going after you, and because now I have a lot of information about you. One of the story about micro-targeting is the following. I'm not going to do it in front of you now, but if I'm going to ask you 10 questions, if I know what kind of a car you're driving, if I know where you're coming from, if I know what you are watching and so on, believe me, I'll know how you're going to vote. And then as a politician, I have only one task. If you're going to vote for me, to make you to go to vote. And if you're not going to vote for me, to convince you to stay home. This is, nobody is persuading anybody anymore. You're mobilizing your own and you're demobilizing the other side. And on the base of all this incredible information coming from social media, from your basically other choices, I really can do it with 92-93% of predictability that I really know what you'll do. And this is changing politics because, ending on this, democracy was governing by argument. And if there is a monument of a democratic citizen, this is a monument of a person who is ready to change her or his views because of an argument. And unfortunately, I don't see this monument anywhere these days.
Ivan, you have cheered us up no end. We have done the honest thing tonight and asked more good questions than we have given good answers. But I think I always distrust people who think they have too many good answers. I thank you for being the first public of what is hopefully going to be a long series of insightful conversations. You've been a wonderfully concentrated, focused public. I thank you for that. And I thank our guest, Ivan Krastev, for kicking off the MQ-Gespräche for, well, the next 100 years.
Thank you for thank not you leaving. All.
Das MQ-Gespräch fand in Kooperation mit dem Bruno-Kreisky-Forum, dem Institut für die Wissenschaften von Menschen und der RD Foundation statt. Das war MQ zum Hören. Vielen Dank, dass ihr heute dabei wart. Bitte abonniert MQ zum Hören, um keine neue Folge zu verpassen. Wir freuen uns natürlich auch sehr über eine Bewertung oder einen Kommentar. Bis zur nächsten Folge von MQ zum Hören. Alles Gute und auf Wiederhören.
Dieser Podcast wurde produziert von Oh, wow!